Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further. Like intellectual bowerbirds, our aim is to collect shiny little objects of knowledge that we think can help build better humans.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. This is Tim Curtis with co-host Ben Pronk.
It is. That I can confirm that is Tim Curtis and I'm Ben Pronk.
He said, don't waste any of your magic. Just press that record button. Let's get going. And let's get going into RV11.
Rendezvous.
What is it?
It's a point of consolidation in a military sense. In our sense, it's where we reflect back on previous episodes and talk to some fantastic comments and questions from listeners.
We had many RVs because there are many times you need to consolidate. And today we're going to reflect on episodes 26, 27 and 28. Jim Molan, Sam Penny and Jack Moshevis, as well as take some questions from listeners. Let's get on with the show.
So, Tim, what did you take away from the Jim Molan episode?
Good diverse chat with Jim. Everything from his early days in the Pacific Islands Regiment, Mgupla Tru, through to planning and leading the war in Iraq as the chief of operations, through to the perspective of the guy who we put in there as his close protection team leader, to politics, family and beyond.
No, it was. It was a good chat. Some interesting thoughts from him, I thought, on the concepts of service into politics and the various pros and cons of having a service background in politics and also having soldiers as politicians. I thought that was good food for thought. It's a bit of a generational thing as well, isn't it, you know?
Mm. And he's not satisfied with having served in uniform, having served out of uniform and into politics. He continues to want to serve, and he described his first foray into politics in the Senate as his apprenticeship and hoping to build on things that he learnt there. And in the last few days, I've been watching the news carefully. He might well see himself back in the Senate due to the resignation of Arthur Sinodinos.
Jim Molan too.
I think it's probably got a fair bit to do with his interview with us that he would be
re-elected. He was very new media savvy, very aware that, you know, people are consuming information in different ways, that traditional ideas of spin are kind of dated and increasingly falling on deaf ears, and that things like this, candid chats with a pair of idiots in a hotel room, that go into a podcast can be a good way of getting a message across.
He talked about border protection. I asked him the question, is our border security policy protectionist? He says no, because I don't think that's relevant. Now, you were involved in the seizing of the MV Tampa in 2001.
Sure. I don't think we'll ever know when the Tampa... I think that's lost in the annals of history.
And there is a fantastic book called Dark Victory by Wilkinson and Maher that talk about the Tampa and the use of the military, specifically the SAS in that operation, and how it was a vehicle for political change. I think we muscled through, well, Australian Parliament muscled through policy change inside 24 hours off the back of the MV Tampa. What were your experiences on Tampa?
Look, at a personal level, it was extremely exciting. I was a young troop commander. We've spoken about the Pong Su, but it was a similar sort of evolution in that one minute we're in the troop office watching Breaking Sky News, the next we're on an aircraft heading to seize that very ship. It was, and I think, you know, retrospective coherence, the benefit of hindsight, these kind of things, we look back and with the full view of what happened and think maybe the SAS response, you know, might have been heavy-handed or sending the wrong message. But remembering back at the time, two things. One, that there was no one else with the capability to board a moving vessel at that stage, at that sort of projection range. And two, we didn't know what was on board that vessel. We had intelligence, everything from, you know, the bridge had been seized by force through to that they were just overwhelmed in terms of numbers. And so it was a very opaque operating environment. And in fact, I remember boarding. Have I told that story?
No, did it in a different interview, I think. Tell it again.
Well, you're getting it again if you've heard it. I remember boarding that thing. We were dressed in our black suits. Like I said, we were expecting everything from armed bad guys on the bridge all the way down. And so, you know, we didn't want to take any chances. We were in a rigid hulled inflatable boat. The Tampa had just crossed into Australian territorial waters, which was the trigger to go from the Prime Minister. And so go we did. We belted out there, and it was very kind of sexy and, you know, very sass. And we got there ready to establish ladders, and they threw down a rope boarding ladder for us, which was a little anticlimactic. We wanted to storm this thing, but we climbed their ladder regardless. And instead of being met by AK-47 wielding terrorists, we were met by a gorgeous 5-foot Norwegian lady dressed in a pristine uniform who said, "Gentlemen, will you please accompany me to the bridge?" And we got into an elevator. Now, I don't know if there was actually elevator music, but in my memory, there was elevator music as we sort of crammed in with our guns and our black suits and our body armor and our helmets, and this gorgeous little pristinely dressed Norwegian officer, and went up in an elevator to a very well-ordered, very in-control bridge, and got the brief from Arnie Rinnan and the captain as to what was going on. And so, again, in benefit of hindsight, maybe we didn't need to go in, you know, as prepared for anything as we did. But as I said, at the time, we did not know what we would meet when we hit that vessel.
Better to be over-prepared than under-prepared.
Yes, yes.
And in the SAS, we never liked a fair fight. We always wanted resources on your side.
Not want to fight on a level playing field. That's correct.
Well, hopefully we can get Jim back at some point to have some follow-up questions on things that we didn't ask him.
Yes.
Okay, episode 27, Sam Penny. He just swims for a living.
Just
well, he does.
Rolls the arms over, imports some cheese. Mungers cheese.
Yeah.
You ever mungered any cheese?
I've monstered some cheese.
Yeah. I don't doubt that.
Okay, Sam has swung the English Channel and he is planning for a double channel swim. No tumble turn, though.
No tumble turn, apparently. And I was a bit disappointed. I thought that was such a clever, funny, witty question. And Sam said, "Every moron asks me that," which put me back in my box very well. Talk about, you know, we started this podcast wondering what makes people go a little further. We love that poem. We love that idea of just incremental improvement, incrementally increasing your goals. And look at this guy, you know, started swimming because his back was getting crooked from riding. And, you know, I can do one lap, maybe tomorrow I can do two. And just by being a pilgrim, going master, always a little further, he's now looking down the barrel of a double crossing. Super impressive.
There's no happiness without struggle. And I actually think that the struggle is less about swimming the channel and probably more about the monotony, not the monotony of swimming the channel, but all of the monotony of doing the preparation day in, day out in order to steady yourself to swim 11 hours or actually in the double channel crossing between 20 and 24 hours. And it does, on reflection, beg the question, if you've put the work in, then actually at the delivery end, same as your MV Tampa example, the results become a little simpler.
Yeah, yeah. Train hard, fight easy. What's your view on boredom, Timmy?
Oh, I get very bored in the swimming pool.
Yeah, I do too. I wonder, though, if a bit of boredom isn't a bad thing to have in your life. Look at my kids, lots of kids. Every waking moment is filled with something, some stimulus, some information, something to get the brain going. I wonder if there's something meditative about being bored, dealing with boredom.
and or monotony. I mean, you've previously...
If we were better researched, there's probably a ton of research on this.
I don't think so. I don't think anyone's...
And how would you find it?
Anyone's writing on stress, anxiety, resilience, monotony, none of that.
Yeah.
Just not really relevant in today's day and age. No, I joke, of course. I mean, you've previously talked about how art, for you, is a form of therapy.
Yeah.
It's very meditative. You're just concentrating on the next pen stroke or paintbrush stroke. And for Sam, he counts to 10 over and over and
I
over
liked that.
Again.
Yeah.
And that's probably in itself a form of meditation.
Mm. And keeps your mind off getting monstered by a great white shark.
His biggest fear, we asked him in Quick Questions, Quick Answers.
No, it was asked.
He said his clear and present fear is sharks.
Mm.
Although no sharks in the English Channel. I've researched that.
I'm taking your word for it.
Coldish water, but no sharks. So 20 to 24 hours swimming next year.
Mate, I don't think I'd want to do something that I really enjoy for 20 to 24 hours, let alone swimming. But no happiness without struggle.
No happiness without struggle. And it sounds as if after this one is done, Sam will look for his next struggle, his next stretch target.
Mm.
Okay, on we go. Jack Moshevis. From aviation apprentice to aviation business owner. What a great bloke and a very, very decent chat.
Jack's a champion. We knew from the second we had a yarn with him in that Qantas Club in Brisbane that this guy had an interesting story to tell. He was leading a life less ordinary. And yeah, I really enjoyed our chat. And apart from anything, you know, it was great going out to Aviation Jack's, seeing his hangar, which was immaculate. You could tell that people were doing good things in there. There was a whole array of aircraft, which was interesting in itself. And then getting a chance to have a yarn with Jack, not just about the aviation side, which was fascinating, but I thought, you know, his approach, his views on life, is, you know, he made fun of himself as not being a philosopher, but I thought there was some pretty philosophical stuff in there. It was good.
Mm. We shared a drink afterwards, not out of the same bottle. but he was also reflecting on his leadership style and saying he didn't necessarily get everything right. He tried to be a good leader day in, day out, but there were times when he felt a little vulnerable. I think one of the things that maybe you can talk to that came through for me in the interview is his authenticity.
Yeah.
Let's talk about authentic leadership.
Yes. The literature would tell you that the fundamentals of authentic leadership are understanding who you are. So being in touch with your own narrative, so how you got to where you are, and understanding what your principles and values are, and not trying to be something different to that. You know, you want to be the best version of yourself, but yeah, you're not trying to be someone else. And I think that resonated really well in our chat with Jack. It was clearly, you know, there was no facade there. He wasn't bullshitting anyone. That was Jack. And, I think that would be a really strong, you know, you could imagine following that guy. You could get on board with what he was doing.
Yeah, a couple of times he said quite simply, I'm just a grease monkey. I'm not a business person. I'm muddling my way through it. And that level of authenticity I actually find quite exciting. We often run up against many people in our corporate lives who think they do know absolutely everything.
Yep.
And if they don't know it, they'll make it up or insinuate something. But I enjoyed it.
No, I agree with you. And that lack of, you know, the blatant self-promotion that we see a lot, and particularly on social media, I find LinkedIn can be a little sort of humble braggy a lot of the time.
Humble.
But When he says something like, I'm just a grease monkey, I'm not a businessman, well, if that's the case, what is a businessman? I mean, he's running this incredible aviation maintenance business. He owns a plane company and producing outstanding aircraft, and he's making a good go of both of those things. You know, if that's not a businessman, then, you know, or business person, I don't know what is.
Good humility, very humble.
Yeah.
Should we go to questions?
Why don't we?
We've got some good ones. Now, just like the question on your leather vest and Mustang that we had an RV ago.
Which was not. I think we clearly ascertained that there was not a leather vest.
Well, I don't know if we clearly ascertained anything. So, in fact, not even a question, but just a statement from Hawks, who you and I both worked with in our very early days in uniform, me a little while before you. And Hawks writes to you, Ben, and he says he's been following the feeds, and just two things for you: get a haircut and have a shave. That's all.
Fantastic feedback from a former platoon sergeant. We, in all seriousness, one of the most, I guess, beautiful relationships in the military is that young officer platoon sergeant relationship. So to set the context, as you graduate out of an officer training school, you'll get posted to a platoon of soldiers, in many cases, about 30-odd soldiers, and you'll be in charge of them. And you will have a bunch of theoretical knowledge. You'll be very keen and enthusiastic, but you will not have a clue as to how the world works. But in that platoon will be a senior soldier, a platoon sergeant, who in the best of these relationships will take you under the wing, stop you making too much of an idiot of yourself, channel, curb, direct your enthusiasm, and provide this mentorship that allows you to work out what actual practical military leadership looks like. And very early in my career, Hawks was one of those, and an absolutely fantastic one of those. So I, you know, can't speak highly enough of the guy. I owe so much of my leadership development to Hawks and people like him, and it's fantastic to still get that little correction there. Get a haircut, have a shave.
Yeah,
I like it.
And those years are very formative, and individuals like Hawks that's willing to try and make a contribution to the development of a young officer. I mean, I think you're a good case in question of how you've been able to carry his advice through, and that's changed the way perhaps that you've applied your principles of leadership through jobs that followed. I think also it's as relevant to a grad coming out of university into a mining company or into an oil and gas company or into an industrials company or into small business, about how you can seek the advice of someone who might not hold the same qualification as you, but has a significant amount of experience to share with you.
Yeah. There's a real complementarity to those kind of relationships, where, you know, there's strengths and weaknesses in both partners that can be, like I said, a real complement to one another, and a real source of learning for well, hopefully both parties. I've got no idea what Hawks would have learned from me as a 21-year-old punk lieutenant.
And you have to be open to the feedback. And a credit to you that you were, perhaps.
Except for the shaven haircut, apparently.
That's right. Next question, from Ben. Ben says, creating work-life balance has been a big challenge for me working in agriculture and mining. I'm really interested to know how you guys managed it while serving and beyond. How do you manage work-life balance? Other Ben.
I am yet to meet any. I think the term is fundamentally flawed, this idea of balance.
It's simplified.
Yeah, and I think it implies that they're equal. You know, if you've got a scale, then you need to have two equal things, two equal weights on either side for it to be in balance. And I don't know that that's very often the case, certainly from a time perspective. So, I don't know about balance. I think integration is a big part. And Tim mentioned before, we spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about resilience within our work. In our professional lives. And I think a big component of that is not being too heavily weighted towards just the work side of things. So while I don't think there's ever a balance. I'm yet to see anyone who's got this sort of real balance. I think that idea of acknowledging that not only is the time spent with family, time spent with social pursuits, time spent with community super important at a personal level, but I think it actually makes you a better employee. I think it makes you more rounded. I think it takes away some of that stress and it provides you a better basis to pursue your vocation. And I we've spoken before about the Renaissance people, Renaissance men. You know, they weren't one-trick ponies. They weren't just pursuing one specific vocation. They had a lot of strings to their bow, and I think that made them better at each of them, having that broader base. And we keep talking about Charlie Munger's lattice worker models, a bit of a clue on a whole bunch of different things. That generalist sort of idea can really help.
Mm. Some musings. We gave a workshop where we challenged the workshop attendees on this word busy. Now, the word busy doesn't sit comfortably with us, Ben. We see it regularly used as an excuse, a reason not to do something, and even a depressive term. We also think busy has a three-bar relationship with stress. You know, being really busy leads to increased stress. In the SAS, we never seemed to be that busy. We were highly effective, we were highly efficient, but I'd say we weren't that busy. And in the workshop, we challenged people to not be busy. And instead of using the word busy, use the word focused. So if someone was asking you how you're going, and instead of saying, been really busy, you'd say, I'm really focused. It's to change in mindset to turn what is essentially now a negative term into something that's far more positive. So how do we get there? How do we get there from being busy to being focused? Well, first, to remove all the distractions.
Mm.
And I'm looking at you because you have many distractions.
Sorry, there was something out the window. I drifted off. I think this idea of mindfulness plays a part. I'm going to murder this guy's name. Chick Mahoney talks about this concept of flow. You know, when you are so engrossed in an activity that you lose track of time, you're in a flow state. You are sort of at one with what you're doing, and the rest of the world sort of drops away. And I think if you can achieve that, and it doesn't have to be a pursuit you particularly like. You know, you can get in flow states, I find, with bodies of work, but it does require you to take some steps to actively block out distractions. And I think that idea of being focused is something you can actually work on. Now, Tim, you're a big fan of the Pomodoro technique?
I use it, yeah. I'd encourage people to do some research on the Pomodoro technique. I think, started back in the 80s. Pomodoro is Italian for the word tomato. The guy who pioneered it used to have an egg timer in the shape of a tomato, hence the name. And it's working in a 25-minute block with a 5-minute break. And in that 25-minute block, you work out precisely what you're going to focus on, and you do away with any distractions. That's no taking texts, no phone calls, no alerts popping up on your computer screen. You're just doing work that is dedicated inside that particular block, and then you take your break. And if there's a disruption, you go back to the start. And what I've personally found is that in 100 minutes or 4 Pomodoros, I can do a day's work.
What I've personally found is it's fun to annoy you in the middle of a Pomodoro because you get all Pomodorish.
But check that out. I mean, we've talked previously about deep work and shallow work, similar concepts, you know, where you're completely immersed in something for a reasonably short period of time where all of your attention must be on that, whether it's writing or proofreading, doing the accounts or bookkeeping or, you know, some design work. And then there are things that can be shallow work, so things that are less important can be more transactional that don't require 100% attention. I personally find the Pomodoro technique works for me. There's the deep work, shallow work theory as well.
I like, because it's time bound, you think you can do anything for 25 minutes. probably couldn't swim for 25 hours, but you can do anything for 25 minutes. And what I find the Pomodoro technique, the few times that I've done it or something similar to it, is it gets you started on stuff. So, you know, the longest journey starts with the first step. You know, just by drafting that proposal or starting that doc review or starting whatever it is, you kind of break its back mentally. You know, you've made a start, you're familiar with it, and you find that you can actually get a fair bit done in 25 minutes. So I like the fact that it helps as a catalyst to actually just get started. You're going to block everything off and you're just going to focus on this body of work. That gets you going. And then I find subsequent re-attacks, coming back to it to finish it off, are much easier.
Now, we've got one of our colleagues that does that very well. He actually writes the framework of the report before he delivers the work. And so when it is time to start writing the report, the architecture is already there for him to write into.
Yeah, he can focus on the content. He doesn't have that mental impediment of having to, oh, God, I've got to start another document. Yeah, yeah. Mm. Good scoop.
Well, I think that's probably about all we've got for today, Ben.
It is, yeah. We're about to embark on a whole bunch of different travel to far-flung places of the world. Keep your eyes on the socials for that. We'll do some little postcards from various corners of the country and the globe.
You're going west, I'm going east.
Yeah.
And I think I see you in about a month's time.
Kind of looking forward to it.
But don't worry, everyone. We will make sure that we speak to you every week. Thanks for listening and see you next time on The Unforgiving 60.
Later.
Since 1973, since he was 17, and by 21 he'd sailed the seven seas, but had never seen that far to him. And he's been to the end of the world, and he sat on the edge and said nothing at all. Well, it's hard to love a man paralyzed, it's even harder to forget. But he looked for the bosom of a beautiful woman, someone that he called mine. But it hadn't happened yet. And he's been to the end of the world, and he sat on the edge and said nothing at all. And he was to my shit on TV.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on The Unforgiving 60.
All you businessmen, politicians, gather around and meet my friend.